Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Well, the snow is starting to fly, and now it's the perfect time to think about flowers and plants and your garden. Joining us today to answer your gardening questions, our first of 2013, it's our own green team, Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York, and an ISA-certified arborist. If you have any questions, tips, strategies for the garden, we'd love to hear about them. Fred and Greg are on hand to help make your garden grow. We welcome your calls, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can do the social media thing. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop. Or you could comment on our Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. Well, gentlemen, nice to have you here on this soon-to-be very snowy day. Fred, what's new?
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be back. If we're here, that means spring has got to be really close. So,
In theory.
In theory, yes. Even though we are on the brink of perhaps last snowstorm of the season.
I wouldn't say that.
You're not going to put your name on that.
All right, and Greg, you brought some interesting things with you today. Witch hazel.
Yeah, there's I snipped three stems of spring blooming witch hazel on the way out of the garden center, a really fun variety that is, they're all fragrant, but is exceptionally fragrant, called Arnold's Promise. Very bright yellow petals with these slightly reddish little cups or calyxes at the base of them. Two others, one a variety called Palita or Palita, which is also yellow, a little longer, a little spidery looking. These petals are really elongated and do remind me of spiders. They're in full bloom now in your yard.
So amazing.
Fred has a variety that is blooming in, actually a different species that's blooming in the arboretum. The varieties that are blooming in containers and in the ground in the Berkshires are also doing it right here in Albany.
You know, I'm not obviously up on any of this stuff, and I don't recall ever seeing these in yards in my neighborhood, but I want to get them. I want to put them in there.
It's a plant that is, you know, does a great job right now of really ushering in spring. Often, though, it's not time to plant, and we'll probably have questions about that. It's a little early. The ground's still frozen. So by the time you're thinking of it, it's often forgotten. But it remember that.
Yeah.
Spring blooming witch hazel. That's all you got to remember.
And the native is fall blooming witch hazel.
Okay, so the fall blooming, the native will be, as you said, one of the last things we see in bloom.
It's the last woody plant. Witch hazels as a group are the first woody plants to bloom, and also as one of the last woody plants to bloom of the year, the native being the last woody plant of our area to bloom. Yeah. And often we'll see those flowers with snow on the ground. The spring blooming ones are so early, same thing happens. They're so early that often, again, we have a snow on the way, and these things are in full bloom. So
very interesting.
Really hardy and no real pest or diseases.
Yeah, for the Berkshires, that the spring blooming ones, typically you can count on them for sometime in late February through March. I have seen them bloom as early as January, but surprisingly not last January, which was very warm. It was several Januaries before where we had a very warm fall and early winter. They opened up a little early. So typically it's February, last week of February, and then well through March, finishing up in April.
Hmm.
And then the fall ones usually are blooming as the leaves are dropping, so mid-October into November.
So theoretically, we could plant the fall ones at my house at some opportune point in the spring?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Either one plant very much plantable in the spring, but if you want to get flowers, yeah, of course, plant a native, and then you'll have them for the fall.
All right, let's go to the phones. Tons of calls already. Carrie in Plainfield, you're first on our first gardening show of the year. Welcome.
Okay, guys, how you doing today?
Good.
Great. I'm presently looking out by the window of my house right now, and I live in a western Mass hill town of Plainfield, and there's a real heavy snowstorm. The way it's coming down now is unbelievable, and I still got 2 feet of snow on my lawn, so
wow.
I find it quite comfortable to know that the garden show for 2013 has begun.
All right.
So, yeah, my question this afternoon is probably for the arborist, okay?
Okay.
I have this huge long needle pine tree. It's about 3 feet in diameter at the base. And about 8 feet from the base a couple of months ago, during a windstorm, I lost a huge branch.
Okay.
That branch was probably, I'm going to say 18 inches in diameter, and it's about 40 feet long.
Wow, big branch.
And there's quite a scar on the tree.
Okay.
And I was wondering, is there any way to patch that scar to save it from disease where I can still save that tree?
Yeah, so basically the branch came off the trunk directly, right?
Exactly.
So we have a big trunk scar.
Exactly.
Yeah, and does it go all the way to the ground, the trunk scar? Or
no, it's probably about 4 or 5 feet from the ground.
Okay, and that was something that recently happened. So that's actually in your best interest. So the answer to your question is, first, there's definitely things you can do to help facilitate closure is the key words here. Contrary to what a lot of information that may be out there, no sort of pruning paints or wound paints should be used on that.
A paint, you said?
Yeah, you do not want to use any kind of paint or sealers. Now, the reason for that is that the tree itself naturally has a defense mechanism to try to either close the wound off or internally wall the decay from spreading. So that's a natural defense that the tree is going to do every time an injury happens, or a perfect pruning cut by a certified arborist. Same response. It's a wound response that basically is going after a closure of the wound. Now, when you take a branch off with a perfect pruning cut, you have a little area where there's meristematic growth, where cells will multiply and divide and begin to close, which is called the branch collar.
Right.
Now, when nature takes one off, and this has happened to our really big oak tree, probably back in 1960s, where a huge branch was ripped off. And what basically happens is that there's no really great branch collar there. So really, there's not a good mechanism for the tree to create this callus tissue, which is what it's going to need to close the wound. So what you've got to do is a technique called wound tracing. And basically, in its simplest form, is basically you're going to get a sharp knife, and you're going to look to clean up the edges of the wound. So the entire scar, you want to remove any kind of, like, maybe bark that's still ragged, edged, and things like that. You want to try to clean it up. And then once you clean up the loose stuff, you look at the actual new tissue, and your goal is to actually trace the wound, hence the name wound tracing. Trace the wound with the knife, just on the just nicking the cambium. And you'll know if you're doing
this.
What's
the cambium?
Well, the cambium, there's a xylem phloem cambium, and to be as simple as I possibly can, it's the veins and arteries of a tree.
Okay.
It's the living vascular tissue.
All right.
So your goal is, the inside of all these trees are sort of like dead wood. It's just used for almost more structure and in terms of support, but there's not a lot of veins and arteries, xylem phloem cambium, that's conducting tissue. So all of the parts that are alive and conducting on a tree are just under the bark. So your goal is to sort of just nick that living tissue all the way around the wound, creating a small green line.
Well, and a question. Would that cambium also be in the center of that scar also,
no,
or just around the circumference of it mostly?
Most likely it would have removed all the cambium in the center, but you'll know it if you get a little knife and you just make a little nick. If you see green, like literally green color,
yes,
that means live conductive tissue, so that means you have it there. So if
this
you
is
see that in
most
middle,
likely going to be close to the bark
it'll
edge.
It'll be really close to the bark edge.
You know, of yeah, the wound.
Okay,
and your goal is to make a smallest, you want to nick it, but you want to do it in the smallest way possible. So more green's not necessarily good. You want to just see a nice continuous row of green all the way around that wound,
okay,
small as possible. And what that does is it triggers a callus tissue to grow, and then that could actually close that wound over. And it may take time since it's such a big tree.
How much time?
But, it could take years.
Really?
It could take
really?
Years.
Yeah.
But I've had really good luck doing that, and I've seen trees that have not had that done start to develop interior rot. So it's important to try to get that wound to close. The good thing about it is he's called early. And if you wait 2 years and try to get the thing to close, you're not going to have great luck. But if you do it in the next month or two, especially right now before it even starts growing.
Yeah, go out during the snowstorm, Kerry. That'll be a perfect time for it. out there.
But it can definitely close.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you, Kerry. Let's get one more call in here before the break. Ann and Saugerties, you're on The Gardening Show.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess this is another question for the arborist. This summer, for the last 3 years, a whole row of white pines have been dying. They're not very big. They're about, I'd say 40 feet tall. And this summer, five of them in a clump died in a very important place.
Oof.
And if they have to be taken down this summer because if they fall, they're going to fall on the house.
Right.
So I think that what's happening is that there's an insect that has actually killed it. The die-off was very, very fast. Within 2 months, the whole tree went from green to brown.
Hmm.
And the bark is now falling off. One of my neighbors had some tree work done, and one of the workers came to her with a very large insect from the white pine, saying, "This is what's been killing your tree."
Mm.
So I have in another part of the lawn some very large white pines that are very important to the whole garden structure. And I wanted, first of all, I wanted to find out whether you knew what kind of insect. How do we take care of the trees that have been cut, and how do I keep it from spreading to the other trees in the other part of the garden?
Okay.
All right. Well, I guess the first thing would be to definitely find out why they're dying. And in terms of large insects, I mean, the only large insect that's coming to the top of my head is a white pine weevil. And a white pine weevil would not kill your white pine. It would kill the tip of your white pine and cause some crooked trunk growth, which is a major pest of the lumber industry, but it wouldn't kill your plant. So I tend to think that the large insect that they found was probably a white pine weevil, and probably was not the culprit for actually killing the trees.
And so having an arborist come to your house and do an inspection, you know, which you would have to pay for, is probably what would work out best, so that you find out exactly what it is that's killing the pine, so that you then can see if that's an issue for the ones that are remaining.
Yep.
And that is it. I mean, in terms of, there are no common boring insects for white pine right now.
Nope. So this really happened fast. I mean, is there something, Fred, that would do that fast?
Well, I'm thinking probably more aimed towards either environmental or disease. That's sort of what I'm thinking, not so much insects. So, but the one question I would have is, do you notice a bunch of sap oozing out of any of the trunk sections of the healthier or still living trees, like a lot of sap?
Well, the still living trees are fairly far away. They're like 500, 600 feet away, so I haven't noticed anything there.
How about on the ones that were dying? Like, as they were dying, did you see a noticeable amount of, like, oozing sap out of the trunk? Or no, they just looked kind of good?
No, I didn't. I just noticed one day that maybe I just hadn't looked up in a while, but that none of the needles were viable anymore. They were all brown, and now it's very easy to take the bark off. I can just take it with my hand, and it peels off in large strips.
Yeah, well, once they're dead, that'll start to decompose.
Oh, okay.
And you'd be able to pull it off pretty easily. And even though they are dead, you might even see some boring activity in and under the bark area, which isn't really indicative of necessarily why it died, but there'll be more secondary problems. But I would were they planted out of curiosity, or were they native?
No, they're native, and what happened over the last 3 years is that the die-off started about 100 feet from the current trees that I'm talking about, and every white pine in that row.
All right, and your connection is very poor. So what we'll do is we'll pick up the answer after the break here and let these guys jump to it. And you can listen on your radio. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. More on The Garden Show. Greg Ward and Fred Breglia coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, New York, presenting Dale Payson's Still Lifes and Francie's Ceramics and Works by Jenny Kemp, opening today through April 14th, carriehaddadgallery.com. Capital Region Language Center, Albany, New York, offering 11 languages for adults and children in and around New York's Capital Region, open house every Tuesday in March at their Albany location from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., crlcalbany.org. Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York. Locally owned and operated since 1988, open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week, FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com. The Albany Academy, Albany, New York, hosting the Albany Children's Book Festival April 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., featuring 50 authors and illustrators open to the public, AlbanyChildren'sBookFestival.org. And Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche, QFCC.com.
1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Just to wrap up Ann's question, you think there's probably not enough information yet to give a real answer.
The thing is, a consultation on site is probably what's going to be necessary to really figure out exactly what's causing it, because my guess is that it's probably not, most definitely not a large insect.
Yeah.
Maybe drought related. I don't know if there was water issues in terms of that. Any kind of construction damage around those trees or even heavy machinery rolling over the root system would be a factor. But again, a lot of unknowns. But the one thing I would say is going to solve our problem, get a certified arborist on site, and they'll definitely be able to diagnose that problem. You can get them online in your area at the ISA's website. I believe that's isa-arbor.com.
Okay.
www.isa-arbor.com. And then there should be a place there where it says search for your local certified arborist. You enter a zip code, and they'll pull up a list in your area. So if you
Very good. Now, Fred, that's Fred Breglia, by the way. Greg Ward also here. It's our garden show. And before we get to Patrick Donges with some questions from social media, you have an interesting technological thing going on at the Landis Arboretum.
That's right. Yeah, we like to say Landis Arboretum gets wired. That's what our press release is going to say.
All right, fair enough. That's a good slogan. Yeah.
What we basically are talking about is we're using QR codes. And for those of you who do not know what a QR code is, it looks very much like a barcode that you would use to scan at a grocery store. Only these are little squiggly, kind of swirly looking barcodes. And you find them on magazine ads. You find them in almost every book you can buy right now.
Sure.
Any kind of advertisement, any kind of box, you go to a store, you're going to see a little tiny weird barcode in addition to the regular barcodes.
Yeah.
And what they are internet-driven QR codes. And what they do is they contain information. So for anyone that has smartphones, which a lot of people have nowadays, you take your smartphone. Almost every smartphone comes with a QR scanner. You use your QR scanner to just basically put it over top of this little symbol, barcode, and it brings you to a website. You don't know it brings you to a website. It just brings up information.
Yeah.
And what we're doing at the Arboretum to add greatly to a lot of the informal learning you can obtain from walking one of our nature trails is we're starting to use QR codes, and that'll be our first trail is our native plant trail, where we're going to have the QR codes as the pilot study. The native plant trail at the Landis Arboretum is a little bit less than a mile trail where we have every single woody plant that's native to New York State that'll live in our zone, plus a bunch that are not that are really not hardy to our zone that we get to live there too, all growing in a less than 1 mile trail. So if you walk this trail, you're going to see all the plants arranged by family grouping. So you go through, you see the oak family, and then you go through and you see the maple family, and you go through and you see the willow family, so forth, honeysuckle family, so forth and so on. And when you get to each of the family groupings, you'll see a bunch of plants. Each of them have a little name, and there'll be a little QR symbol. And the good thing about Landis Arboretum is that we have some pretty good elevation, which means in our area, means no matter what carrier you have, you get really good signals at the Arboretum. So we figured let's capitalize on that.
Sure.
So what we're going to do is you'll see at almost every one of these plant groupings, and you're going to see more and more grow as we move forward.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see a little QR code. You scan it. And then you'll actually get to listen to our native plant curator, Ed Miller, who actually is the founder of the Native Plant Trail, explain in his own words, literally, about the family grouping.
Brilliant. And it'll keep the cost down on tour guides. I like it.
Exactly. It's going to, you know, the tremendous, tremendous educational value, I think, that we can add to our different trails.
What a great idea. Now, Patrick Donges, our producer, is here with a question from social media.
Guys, we have one question from Drea on Facebook, and she says, I have a side yard in downtown Troy that's mostly debris and some soil. A house was knocked down there. I want to put in three trees. I was thinking magnolia, cherry blossom, and crabapple. Are these trees good? Are these good trees for the area, rather? How deep does soil have to be to plant a tree? She says she'll put in topsoil and compost. And how deep should the trees be planted? Thanks a bunch.
Wow, they're great,
great
trees.
Questions.
Yeah, great questions.
And great trees.
But those, the magnolia, crabapple, and some kind of ornamental cherry. They're all really fun, colorful plants. You will have your bloom time somewhat extended, but it will be all by between probably mid-April and mid-late May.
Mm.
So you could consider moving some of that bloom time to a little bit later. So hawthorn will give you kind of a May-June bloom. Hydrangea would give you an August bloom. Rose of Sharon. These are a little smaller than the trees you mentioned, but I like all of those. In terms of soil?
Yeah, well, one thing you would want to be aware of. Now, she said she had it sounded like a pretty rocky, did she say rocky, kind of tough
soil?
Just
mostly debris and some soil.
Yeah, so that sounds like a tough site, what we call a tough tree for a tough site.
Right.
So anything that you're going to think about tough, crab apples, they like heavy, thick soil. You give them that, they're going to be happy. So you really want to match the site to the tree. And if you have bad soil, it's not... from an arboricultural standpoint, it's never a really great idea to bring in a bunch of soil to try to make a tree that's not going to like it there.
Okay.
It'd be better to find something that likes heavier soil. And if you want to amend that soil a little bit, make it happier, that's okay.
All right.
So the crabapple, great. Cherries also take it really dry. They can tolerate that.
Okay.
Magnolias, unfortunately, like a more moist soil and a little richer, more organic soil. So really drought-stricken sites, which anything that has some debris and a little bit of soil means probably pretty severe drought in summer.
Yeah,
magnolia may want to reconsider that.
Okay.
And so amending that soil though would be what I would recommend certainly, and would be more than adequate to bring it up to magnolia quality. Would you say
you might be able
The debris it probably should be removed. We should definitely be
Yeah.
It sounds like she's going to work hard at this, so we would want to pull that away. And then, bringing in the compost would allow the all of those plants to do pretty well.
How deep would she have to go is the other
and then
question.
The most important thing is that the amended soil, 15, 18 inches would be fantastic.
Okay.
That would be really good for trees. The trees themselves may not be planted that deep. It depends on the size of the root ball.
Great.
All right.
And it depends on the root flare. I always tell people to look for root flares. The place where the trunk meets the roots will be a little flare. And you want to make sure that flare is either exactly at ground level or very a little bit above.
Okay.
But if it's dropped down below, and sometimes with the mistake that I see a lot of people make with planting trees is they overdig a hole, they stick it in, and then the tree, even though you maybe press the soil down into that hole, it's going to settle.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do that, you probably want to plant a little bit on the high side. But the root flare above ground level, not
great.
Below.
Fair enough. Patrick
Don,
just thank you very much,
my
friend, and thank you for checking in via, I believe it was Facebook.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to the phones. Karen in Richfield. Karen, you're on.
Hi. My question is for the Greg Ward, the gardener.
Okay.
I'm a longtime gardener, but I have tall trees encroaching on my garden, so I want to move it to a hayfield. It's right up on the edge of our lawn, longtime hayfield, and I'm wondering what's the best way to prepare that. I could move it next year, too. It doesn't have to be this year, but... what's the best way to get that ground ready so I get rid of those perennial weeds? And I can't stand the idea of using Roundup or anything like that.
Right, right. No, if you wanted to wait, you certainly could, use some other kind of cover. You could also, you could mulch this area with straw or hay that was cut already and allow that to act as the mulch to kill all those plants. But if you if you were energetic, you could certainly, mow off that area a little bit when it warms up to get it down to, a short sod. You could then either, till that and rake out the sod clumps, or till that and then let it sit with a plastic over the top of it.
Okay.
That with plastic.
Plastic is going to be it's essentially going to act as the the herbicide. It's going to keep the seeds from germinating. It's going to kill all of the root system of the hay or the hay field that is still existing.
Right. Okay. Great. How about incorporating some chicken manure type hay? I use hay for bedding for my chickens.
Yeah. The other option is to plant. Above ground no-till method. There are some pretty good, a while back I brought some of that in and I can't remember the website now, but some pretty good no-till preparation, little pictures and even videos.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, you're never going to be tilling the soil. You will simply be piling material, either hay and or compost, on top of a layer of, say, paper or cardboard.
Okay.
All right.
And that's just another way to do it. That if you started that now, you probably could be planting in June. But if you're willing to wait until spring, I think that's going to work out. The following spring, 2014, that would be ideal.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Jeff in Poughkeepsie. Jeff, you're on.
Oh, hey. Thank you. Tell me if there's a problem, but I'll shut my car off if I have to.
All right, so far so good.
Okay, question. Number one is cantaloupe. Two would be tomato. I tried cantaloupe the first time last year, and it took a long time for little buds, little cantaloupes to start to appear. It's pretty late in the season. I got one cantaloupe out of it. The other one, the bottom seems to rot as it grows, laying on the ground. And the squirrels come in and just start eating a little bit, and the rest rots out with the bugs. Any suggestions on how I can safely grow cantaloupe?
All right.
Yeah, definitely warming the ground and or using a, again, a mulched material. Often plastic is actually another use. I like to use that woven polypropylene fabric that allows allows moisture to pass through. And so placing that over your garden area, cutting holes in that and planting through the holes, so you will have already amended that soil before you put the fabric down, really does make a big difference in terms of keeping the ground warm, keeping the fruit when it does form, actually gives it a little bit of a barrier between the soil, so a little bit of rotting is less likely. Mm. You can also, once you plant and get them well established, even watering, but you should also consider using a floating row cover over the top of the plants until they're well established and blooming. So this is a material that is white and kind of see-through, that looks sort of like a cotton sheet, but it's very airy, and you tuck it all around your plants so that they're underneath this blanket.
Oh, that'll rise up? It will mat it down?
Yes, and it's very light, but you're giving them enough room that it will rise up. The plants will fill out underneath there. That will keep essentially virtually all your insect issues at bay while they're growing. It will also hold in a little bit more heat, so that will actually allow them to grow a little quicker. Once you start to see flowers, you do want to uncover it so that you can get some pollination. And at that point, you don't need to put it back on. So this would be from soil's going to be warm, Poughkeepsie, maybe the middle of May, but say the late May to be safe. And then you're going to plant, cover, and you'll be probably pulling that cover off by the 4th of July.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. That was Greg Ward. Greg runs Ward's Nursery in Great Barrington. Fred Breglia also here. He is an ISA-certified arborist and director of the Landis Arboretum. Let's go to, let's not go to that. Let's go to this. John in New Paltz. John, you're up.
Hey, you there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
I've got a spruce in my backyard that's probably, 30, 35 feet. Maybe it's a Norway spruce, and it's always been, looking really good. And I thought it started to look a little dull, and I went back and checked it out, and I saw that there was lichen on the branches.
Okay.
My whole yard is damp.
Okay.
And so I wondered, is lichen something that can sap the tree or be damaging to the tree, or should I not worry about it?
Well, that's a really good question, because actually you would not believe how many times I get that call over at the Arboretum. I get that question a real lot because a lot of people have it. Now, to answer your question, is it's not hurting the tree.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't call it a symbiotic relationship because, I don't really think that the lichen's giving anything back to the tree.
However,
so it might be a one-sided relationship.
Yeah, is creating a symbiotic relationship with fungi and algae.
That's
right.
It's
a very complicated.
It is.
Yeah, I was surprised. I looked that up, and I was amazed to find that, I thought that was kind of fascinating, what actually lichen is.
That's
yeah.
right. The good thing about it is that it grows naturally at places where the air quality is fairly good. You don't see it in a lot of downtown cities because it doesn't like that kind of climate. It has very low pollution levels.
Uh-huh.
So the fact that you see it on your tree is I would say that's probably a good sign. The air around your home is pretty good.
In general, it does. I agree with Fred. It is never the issue with the tree, but I do think, and this is purely subjective on my point of view, I do think that it is a clue that there may be some issues with the rate of growth, or that the fact that the tree may be not being as vigorous as it could be. It has nothing to do with the lichen other than the lichen you know, is going to have a hard time growing on something that's growing quickly. And so if your tree is not looking good otherwise, if there's some other issues there, you know, the lichen can sort of be a clue that maybe there's, you know, something else is happening.
Yeah.
But the tree itself looks good to you?
Well, that's what I say. I'm starting to wonder if maybe it's just, you know, my imagination that it didn't look as, you know, as vibrant as I, you know, had normally, used to see it. But otherwise, yeah, I guess it's all right. I mean, it's not dropping needles or anything.
It still looks pretty full. The color's a little, this time of year, the colors of the spruce will be a little different than they will once they're growing. Because, you know, they've been, those needles have been sitting all winter. So they do tend to have a less vibrant color to them this time of year, and then that should pick back up and look real normal in the summer. But if it doesn't, or you start to see any other kind of signs, like you're starting to get a thinning needles or less needles or any kind of decline from the top of the tree, then, you know, certainly you could get a hold of me at the Landis Arboretum. And, you know, you could talk more about that if that situation comes up. But again, the lichen on the tree, not actually going to be the cause of any decline. And if the tree looks healthy, then I would say you're probably all right.
All right, John, let us know how the trees look, later in the spring and summer. Let's take a break, Zach Malloy, and we'll be back with more calls at 800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from St. George's School, Clifton Park, New York, hosting an open house on Saturday, March 9th from 1 to 3 p.m. for their all-day pre-K and after-school enrichment program, stgeorgeschoolcp.org. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond, 518-580-8080. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Fulton Landing, New York, presenting the Round the Lake Challenge, providing 30 missions to explore Lake George, lglc.org. And Woodstock School of Art, offering classes and workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, and more for all levels. Tuition assistance available, woodstockschoolofart.org.
It's Vox Pop. It's exciting because it might be snowing where you are, but by golly, we got a gardening show here. Fred Breglia is here from the Landis Arboretum and Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery. Greg, some events already?
Well, yeah, March is our spring open house month. We are, you know, really up and ready, mostly on the inside. Lots of fun, you know, color, lots of, you know, ready to go sort of, you know, seed starting houseplants and things. So at the same time, we have these really fun seminars. We're going to this Saturday on March 9th, this Saturday at 10 a.m., we're going to have home composting made easy. So you can come and learn just what compost is all about and how you too can compost. And then next Saturday at 10 a.m., we're going to have the highest impact with the lowest maintenance plants. And this is a good friend designer, Terrence Trapp from Webster Landscapes in Sheffield, will come in and do actually a slide presentation. Not something to be missed. He really does know his stuff and will review lots of really fun plants that will be really easy to grow in your yard.
Well, you know, this is a perfect dovetailing with the question we just received from Facebook. Rebecca on Facebook asks, I want to put some plants in the front of my new house. We're in Malta, New York. The soil is very sandy. What are some pretty plants that do not require a lot of time to maintain?
Well, if she doesn't want to come by on Saturday the 16th at 10 a.m., this is a free lecture, by the way, or free slide presentation, then she could definitely give us an email and we can come up with a big list of things. We'll probably ask about exposure, how tall the house is, where the windows are. There's a lot of different choices there, and that is something we certainly can offer.
Yeah, well, I would just say plant witch hazel because they're really nice.
And right now, you
when
could.
When in doubt, plant witch hazel.
all right, and then we have Dave asking, I forgot to spray our apple and pear trees with dormant oil earlier.
No, he didn't.
Is it too late?
Not too late.
No, it's not too late?
It's too early, Dave.
Yep. It's too early, Dave.
He's 2-3 weeks at least, 2-3 weeks early.
So you have time to spray. What is dormant oil, by the way?
Dormant oil is usually paraffinic, or horticultural oil is paraffinic, can be vegetable. It is something that is mixed with water and sprayed on the woody parts of your plants, in this case fruit trees, to kill and or inhibit overwintering insects and disease spores.
Oh.
And you do this before the tree leaves out or just as the buds are swelling. So this is typically done in April in our listening area. And you can do it more than once, but you want a sunny, dry 24 hours with above freezing temperatures.
Okay.
So that's April.
Perfect. So, Dave, it's not too late. This is great. I love good news. Let's go to Debbie in Sheffield. Debbie, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, I have a couple of ash trees that are sort of really tall, and they're, I suppose they have this long hair horned beetle, and I've asked to get a couple of them, to get them cut down, and they want like $2,500.
Yep. I have some tricks for you. I think that's where you're going, right? Yes.
So is there any other way?
Yes. Yep. First off, well, just to clarify, my guess is that it's you've probably got the emerald ash borer, not the Asian longhorn beetle. And the only difference is that the emerald ash borer, although a significant pest to ash trees, is not much of a pest to any other trees that we have. The Asian longhorn beetle, which is not in the area right now and hopefully won't ever be, has a very, very, very large host range of trees that it will unfortunately attack, including all of our sugar maples and hardwoods, oaks, things like that. So luckily that's not here yet. Let's deal with your ash and the emerald ash borer problem. So obviously you have some big trees, they have to get removed. One way to help cut down costs on tree removal, because a lot of it is in removal, and that's the key word here. The key is to try to get your cost down by actually getting a tree company in that's qualified to get the wood on the ground. So in other words, it's a lot cheaper to just have a tree company come in and take the tree down. It'll often be a fraction of the cost that it would for the complete cleanup. Now, depending on what kind of tree you have, that may or may not work. Ash, luckily for you, is good burning wood. And what I've done with people over the years is said, look, can you get a quote from a tree company just to get, and I've done this at my own house, had them take it down and then get either a sign, put it out on the lawn, say free firewood. And you almost always can find somebody to come in and take ash, because ash is good burning wood. And
it's really tough to get these people to do it because they're all so busy. Although this is a perfect time to do it.
It is.
Because before it all comes back to life again here.
Yep, so as long as you can tolerate.
And I have room for it for them just to lay it down on the ground because it's a hill.
Yes. Then
in back of the house.
In that case, get a quote to just take the trees down.
And Debbie, you know, get more than one quote. Maybe you have already, but get a few. I'm sure you can come up with a few names there in the phone book.
You'll find a wide range, by the way, of prices. I have done this myself, and it's pretty amazing. Debbie, thanks a lot. Let's go to Jim in Vermont. Hi, Jim.
Hey there.
Hello.
I live on the banks of the Hoosick River. I've been here for about 35 years now, and the area's right on the edge of the river. Used to have ostrich fern and Dutchman's britches and bloodroot. And now it's all being overrun by Japanese knotweed.
Yes, that's...
And I'm an organic kind of guy. I don't want to go down there and spray a bunch of chemicals around, but I would love to be able to get rid of this stuff. How do I do it?
A few options. I deal with that at the Arboretum, too, because we actually have that as a problem. And one of the things you can do, if you're persistent enough, is you can actually get rid of it by continuously cutting it. And once you put the effort in, then it goes away. And unless you have an area where it can spread from and continue to get into your area, then you should be good for quite some time. And I've removed huge patches of this plant doing that.
This is with a weed whacker.
Like go down there with a machete or a scythe or something?
Well, what I've used, but I have pretty industrial Japanese knotweed patches, so I've used a gasoline-powered, it looks like an industrial weed whacker, only it has a blade on it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you come in, right, exactly. And you got to remember how plants grow in the spring, and this is the best time to get them. In the spring, they're going to grow out using stored energy. They don't photosynthesize until they actually get up above the ground and get leaves.
Mm. So nail them while they're real young.
Let them use that stored energy to give the quick, fast growth. And then once you see that quick, fast spring growth, don't let them photosynthesize. Ooh. Get in there, whack them back. They're almost guaranteed going to resucker.
And then whack them
again. And if you see a few little stragglers, whack them again. Wow. You might have to do it like four times. But
yeah.
I've had great success getting rid of Japanese knotweed that way.
It's a violent show.
Thank you so much.
About once a week would be adequate. You wouldn't need to do it more than that. So
yeah, no, not more.
Put it on the calendar, you know, for to do it once a week. And if you did it four, five, six times at the most, you really will do it.
Beautiful.
And great.
Be aware, you'll leave little pockets here and there. You know, if you just be persistent, be constant vigilance.
Okay.
And that actually works for any woody plant that's a that's what we would call a pest.
Yeah.
An invasive. You could almost control almost all woodies relatively easy with just mowing.
Let's go to Lisa in Albany. Lisa, you're on.
Hi. My question is, how do I find someone to hire to spray my property with the wax substance that kills or inhibits Lyme ticks?
Well, there are companies that would offer that. Some of them are often arborists, because arborists tend to offer that kind of service for ornamental trees, and therefore they are already certified to do sort of generic spraying or blanket spraying of your yard. So that's where I would start.
What do you think of this? I'm a native Rhode Islander, and there's a Professor Mather at the University of Rhode Island who has developed a substance that is not like pesticides. It's just wax, I understand. And you can just walk into your local hardware store and ask for someone to come and spray your property for about $500 for a couple of acres. Do they have that around here? And what do you think of the substance, or do you know of it?
I am not sure what substance you're talking about. That is not ringing a bell at the moment. You know, I'm in Massachusetts, and in order to hire someone to come to your property and spray, they need to be a certified pesticide applicator. I believe the same is true in New York.
Although if it was just wax, that may
fall.
Don't
think it's a pesticide.
Interesting. Yeah. Fred, you've not heard of this?
I'm not familiar with this either. No, the wax I'm not sure about.
We can go to a website at the University of Rhode Island and look up Professor Mather. He's the current reigning expert on Lyme disease.
Interesting.
Okay, yeah, well you've given us some homework, first off. We'll certainly be checking that out later. But I do agree with you. I think the no spray chemical type thing is you know, what's worse. So
yeah.
You know, if you could find a wax thing that's not, you know, harmful, then that would be great. And if this guy's advocating that and he's the leading expert on Lyme disease, then that sounds like, wow, that's something that I would tell our visitors as well. So I'm going to research it out.
That's great.
If you ever do find out the exact thing to do with that, if you would let me know also at the Arboretum.
Maybe Lisa could call back in or email you directly.
Email
what is
me.
Your contact information over there?
It's fred@landisarboretum.org. fred@landisarboretum.org. And I would love to know the answer to that.
How about you, Greg? What's your contact information?
Yeah, so wardsnursery.com is the website, and there's an email link there, info@wardsnursery or wards@wardsnursery. I'm not sure which. I think it's info.
Okay, well, we'll just click the link and you'll be good to go. Yeah, Stephanie in Kingston, you're on. Stephanie.
Hi. I had a question. I have started gardening in my own garden in the past couple of years, and I've noticed a decrease in production. And I was wondering, nutrients and stuff. I'm not familiar with how to test my soil or what to do to increase production, but I definitely don't want to, or haven't wanted to fertilize or anything. Was there any of that composting or whatever suggestions you have?
Yeah, so what's happening is you're talking about a vegetable garden, I assume.
Right, yeah.
And so these things are annuals. You're putting them in every year. They're taking out a tremendous amount of energy, and you haven't been putting anything back.
Right.
Right. So compost, you know, has a lot of that energy.
Okay.
And so working in, you know, 2, 3, 4 inches of compost into your soil, if you're tilling that in, that's fine. If it's no-till, you lay it on top, and then it works its way into the soil. It leaches into the soil. There are organic fertilizers. So these are fertilizers derived from, you know, sustainable materials. They are certified. You can, you know, consider applying those. And the reason I mention that is that they are they pack a bigger punch. Even though they're organic, they have what you need in a more concentrated area or product. And so it does provide you with a more effective way of doing it. However, composting can work really well. Once you get your garden planted and composted, you can continue during the summer with what's a thing called compost teas. So you can be taking that same compost that you have been using and making a tea out of it, and that's a whole recipe that I'm sure you can find online, but basically you're soaking that in the sun for a certain period of time, a few days, and then you're pouring that out and using that to water your plants with. And so you can you probably can look online and just find the exact recipe for all that, but that's a very simple way, so that you're taking the nutrients out of the compost and kind of concentrating them in this liquid form, and therefore getting it to your plants more quickly. The whole point of vegetable gardening, or the whole issue with that, is that these plants, our season is short. These plants are growing a lot during the long days, you know, up through the end of June. And if you can get them all up and going, then, you know, the rest of the season they sort of coast. And so you want to make sure that the nutrients are available then.
Okay, Stephanie, thank you so much. We go over to Fox in Vermont. Fox, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon. Hey. I'm in Traveling Street, Vermont, and I'm from Kentucky, Louisville area, but I went to Walt Disney for the last 10 years with my kids and grandkids, but I found these acorns that were really fresh that fell off, of course, the acorn tree. I was just wondering if you could plant those, and are they seeds that you could replant those acorns in Kentucky, and is it safe?
Fred.
You know, it would depend on the species of tree that you took the acorn from. My guess is it's probably a live oak and in Florida. And if that's the case, I don't think that they would live in Kentucky, but you'd have to check the hardiness zone of that area. It's all about hardiness zones. Now, that being said, you can always push the limits of any plant. That doesn't mean it's going to work, but for example, we have we're at zone 5 over at Landis Arboretum, and we have a one tree, a Spanish fir, Abies pinsapo, which is planted back in 1951 by the founder of the Arboretum, Fred Lape, and that's rated for zone 7. And it's been alive since 1951, so it, you know, it's doing well. There are some plants you can push a zone or two, especially if you can find a little microclimate. But if your zone's not going to support live oak, which is probably what this is going to amount to, then it's probably not going to work for you. But
Kentucky does, it depends on where. Kentucky has some warmer places. I mean, it isn't the Berkshires or Vermont, that's for sure. And, you know, as a self-described plant geek, I would go for it. Try it out, because, you know, that's the only way you're really going to find out.
Okay. Well, good luck. We appreciate. Go ahead. Say it again, Fox.
I wanted to find out just a quick answer, and I'll take the answer off the phone. How would you plant an acorn, just like you pretty much most of your plants?
Okay. That's a good question. All right. We're going to let you go, and you can listen on the radio.
Sure. Well, there's a number of different, at least in the Northeast, I'll speak from, you know, where we are right now. There's two groups of oaks. One of them's a red oak group, and one of them's a white oak group. And there's a lot of oaks within each of those groups, but they all fall into similar traits. Now, the Native Americans preferred the white oak group for eating because they tend to be a little sweeter. The red oak group tends to be a little bit more bitter. The white oak group and the red oak group, the red oak group will actually sprout and throw a little radical down, but no top growth. It'll just kind of put a little root.
Yeah.
The other group will actually wait till spring, and that'll set that in the fall. The other one will actually do it in the springtime. It'll send out a root and a shoot at the same time.
Huh.
So one throws a root, holds itself, and then shoots it later. The other one does both. So, but generally, you know, the way the acorns would naturally reproduce is they would fall onto the ground. There'd be a minimal amount of covering over them. They'd sit through a cold period, which is the key. In both cases, it needs to go through a cold stratification.
How long of a cold period?
Well, around here, it'd be the winter.
Okay.
You know, Florida.
So 90 days.
Okay.
Yeah, 90 days to break that, what they call stratification, make that seed viable.
Okay.
To get the exact information on any particular plant, you really want to know exactly what species that we're looking for. So if you could tell me that that was a live oak, which is what my guess would be, then I could tell you exactly what you would need to know for live oak. And if you want to talk more about this, I have all of the different types of techniques and different periods of stratification, temperatures, types of soil, et cetera, all on my office. So
all right.
you can get me again at Fred at Landis Arboretum.
All right, gentlemen, we're out of time, but thank you very much. We kicked off 2013 in style. Thanks to Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. Apologies to everybody we left on the line. We'll be back again, and we'll do it one more time. Support comes at many more times. Support comes from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, newly renovated boutique hotel in the heart of the Hudson Valley. 12 guest rooms with modern amenities and located close to the rail trail and outdoor activities. The 1850house.com. Unison Arts Center, New Paltz, presenting the second Sunday Salon Series, featuring a conversation with Broadway film and television composer and Metropolitan Opera guest guitarist and lutenist Frederick Hand, Sunday, March 10th at 2, unisonarts.org. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking, ashfieldstone.com. And Smith College Museum of Art, presenting second Friday, March 8th from 4 to 8 p.m., Art and Activities for All Ages, featuring Collecting Art of Asia, smith.edu/artmuseum. Thanks to Zach Malloy and also Matt Don Diego for answering the calls. The news is next.